Welcome to the Artist Interview Series. In this podcast, we feature interviews with the brightest musicians and music educators from around the world. Our goal is to provide meaningful conversations and insights into their creative process. We'll discuss the inspiration behind their music while learning about the life and experiences of these talented musicians. Our host today is William Crawford, a Lilly Theatre Company drum instructor and associate producer. In this episode, we spend some time talking with Boston native David Moore. Moore is an accomplished artist, painter, musician, and educator. David Moore's reputation is built on exhibitions of glowing reductive paintings that have a beautiful nuanced surface and intense mark making. His paintings combine repeated gestural abstraction and the energy of curvilinear structures. Feel free to visit his website at lessismore.com. And now, here's your host, William Crawford.
We are live. Artist interview. We have a very special guest here. Fabulous artist. He also plays saw music. Please give a warm welcome to Mr. David Moore. A little bit about David Moore. He is a painter, a musician, educator, but I recently learned you retired this year. He's very clear. You have a wealth of experience in the arts, and so many people can see you as a source of inspiration. On Clark Gallery's website, they share Moore's reputation in Boston is built on exhibitions of reductive paintings that have a beautiful non-surface.
Yeah, I mean, the minimal reductive work, I still do, but I also have a lot of these other works that are an explosion of the rigidity after so many times, and yikes, I get into something. It's very obsessive and engrossing and repetitive and sort of a mantra to that word. And this is the sense of freedom. And I'm like, yeah, both. It's sort of like, you have a score where you improvise.
Yeah. So where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in Salem, Mass. And then I stayed around Massachusetts. We moved around a lot and went to live in Weston, Westfield, Danvers, Wakefield. Then, went to school in Boston, in Mass Art, and then, lived in Boston. And then, all kinds of weird odd jobs, you gotta make money somewhere. And then I worked in an after school program, and, all along, I was playing music and going to the clubs and, open mics or playing in the streets, busking in Harvard Square before it was amplified in the 80s. And I lived on Green Street and I'd just walk up there and then have a dollar hamburger at the Tasty, which used to be right in the corner. So I did a lot of music in the streets there and met a lot of people playing in the streets. It was really fun. Yeah.
That's what Boston.
So that was the 80s. And then, in terms of where I lived, I lived in Cambridge and I moved to New York City. But I also had a place here. So I was going back and forth. And I miss Manhattan tremendously. So I go as much as I'm able to. I have a dealer there and a gallery. And they may continue to show work. You never know. So they haven't shown it for a while. And then you mentioned Clark Gallery, and Danny Salvo is a good dear friend of mine, and he started that. But it was owned by a previous person who lived in Weston. Apparently, they used to trick or treat at her house, ignoring this whole scenario. And then, but now I'm working with Ellen Miller Gallery, and I just finished a giant commission for the Winthrop Center. It was a 6x10 foot painting. It's like this blue one. They came and said, "Hey, do you have anything bigger?" And I said, "Oh yeah, sure. That's no problem." It was a lot of work. So anyway, I can tell you more about that later. But do you want to know more about school or
Yeah, well, you've earned a MFA degree in painting at Bark House, New York. You were talking about that.
Yeah, the terminal degree. I don't know what that actually means. They can teach anywhere, any college or something. But I also went to Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture in Maine. Sort of who's who in American art. I studied with from Louise Nevelson to Philip Perlstein to all kinds of people. There was a big thing there. And in the meantime, before I would get my MFA, I would go to art retreats as well as McDowell Colony, Yaddo, different places, Edward F. Albee Foundation, Montauk. So in Virginia, anyway, so that was sort of gift of time and sort of hopping from one to the next and making money to get to be able to go. So I did that in the 80s a lot. And Blue Mountain Center in Adirondacks, like a home away from home. So all of those things led to, I should get my MFA now. So I did that over 3 years and I was still working full time and working with after school kids. And then I ended up, I had to move out of New York and get a full-time job. And so I ended up teaching public school.
Nice.
And before that, I was teaching part-time and sometimes full-time at an alternative school in Dorchester, the Log School, part of Federated Neighborhood Dorchester Houses. And that's where I kind of learned how it was like to teach. I was working with junior high kids getting out of gangs, going into gangs, doing murals, and teaching them how to like respect themselves and others somehow. And so that's where I learned and became good friends with the director, Joe Carpenito, who later on, he's now a sculptor. And he turned me on to jazz. This is the jazz all the time. But I always had a deeper place for blues and gospel. And when I was in high school, I saw B.B. King.
Wow.
At Fenway Park. And I didn't know this at the time, when he played up in Danvers area, he stayed overnight across the street from me at a friend's house who was his work buddy's bus and his bus driver for years. And he was there right across the street. I never knew that. So this kind of this weird vibe is like, and he's the nicest guy. And I got to meet him and talk with him later when I was playing at some gig in the Seaport somewhere. Hmm. And he got his bus and his bus is like this beautiful, Airstream style interior and this rounded sort of recording rehearsal studio in the bus, and nicest guy. So yeah, so I brought my saw and he looked, he's autographed it. Yeah, he knew what it was. A very southern thing. It's associated with more country or southern music. Jug bands and so on, but I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in like using New Orleans and play there, but I see it as another thing, and the sort of the nuance of tones, and so play it with someone. But it's like it's really interesting. Oh, so you're gonna play, and then the whole band was sitting around, and they said, "Well, they all of a sudden turned to." Instruments down, back off, don't give any rhythm. Because they know what the hell this thing is. And they're walking in with a guitar case and pull out a saw. And they're kind of like, uh-oh, we're in trouble. What's he going to do now? Oh, gee, the poor guy, he's going to do it. How are we going to do this? That's one of the best toured all over the country playing the festivals. Yeah. that the art experience is predominant. That's what. And I knew that since I was four. It's a DNA thing. It's sort of part of my obsessive nature, maybe. And instead of the restaurant, just straighten everything out. You know, this you can't have that. This could be there. A quarter of an inch over to the left, you know. But it's sort of a, what we call like a metaphysical part to the painting. It's like there's a beginning, middle, and end. And somewhere between the middle and end, something that never ends, just goes to another one and you abandon it. But it's like, it's stopped time. You have no idea what time it is. You could be doing it for 20 to 30 hours, not know. Or 2 minutes feels like a long time. You don't know. It's like, if you're that focused in the moment, the time is stopped time. So I would go like, paint in the South End, had a studio there, and I'd take my easel and set up, and I'd do plein air, urban landscape realist painting. It was like a sort of tradition of the painter in Boston, George Nick. Mm-hmm. He was a big influence. He taught me a lot about color, or the immediacy of making marks and keeping making changes. So anyway, I started doing a lot of painting, but I knew it was something else more. And one time I did all these abstract drawings, and I would take graphite powder and then grind it with an eraser and do all these pattern paintings, drawings, like big, like 6 foot drawings and rolls of paper. And I'd fill up an entire room at Mass College of Art with all these drawings. And nobody knew what the hell, what are you doing? What are you, I do both. It's drawing. I could draw that. This, like, why not do this instead? So I still have those from 1972, 3, 5, you know. And they relate to what I'm doing now. I had no idea that I would do something similar. Sweats. 40 years later, you know, weird. So. Anyway, that's like really the core, sort of absorbing your sense of place and making it your own, sort of a sacred time, and the nuance of meditation in front of work, and just stare at something for hours. You know, it's like, wow. Oh, I never saw that before. I mean, the painting physically never changes. It's always that, but you keep changing when you look at it. So the content is very fluid. So if you're aware of what you're thinking, want to explore other things floating in your mind, like you're kind of looking at something and it makes you, oh, I now I remember something else, you know? Mm. So it's kind of what works for me that way. The other kinds of things I've done, in a teaching role or a facilitating role, I've worked with inmates at Bridgewater and it's called 1% for the Arts. I did a giant, it was a 60-foot mural, a large painting of the sky and clouds. But I said, I'm not going to do this unless I work with the inmates, and they do murals too. So we had a class and we would meet every week, and I worked with a therapist and me. So it was kind of a great team. Like, I was doing the art and she was doing the therapy about it, because I'm not a therapist. And it was really successful in some ways. And then I did a program for a homeless group called the Boston Night Center, and it was for the Arts Lottery monies. Hmm. And you had to be a program for residents in Boston. But because they were homeless, they weren't funded. Mm. I said, well, no, they're living here. They don't have an address. But anyway, so I challenged them and they funded this program. So once a week, we'd go there, make art with people. Did stuff with teens and Dorchester Y. And, you know, but then it's a, I got elementary school in Newton, and then the Arlington High School, and I was there for 24 years. So, but I also did a lot of theater stuff. I ran a community theater program and a CETA job in the late 70s as a performance art. And then I did this work with this woman, Adriana Pazzi, and she was one, she was called Mama Coconut with Kid Creole and the Coconuts from Florida.
Yeah.
Kid Creole. And she still kind of managed. They were married, then separated. So I did some recordings for her. That's on the album Tag. It was on Amazon that she put out. And she reissued some things. I think the song's still on. And it was really hard to balance time to teach public school and make the time to paint. Say, well, you have your summers off. No, you got to get ready. So, but I was always able to paint no matter what. And you know, you mean other people influenced me. There's another guy, David Driscoll, who I met at, was my teacher in Skowhegan. And he was brilliant, incredibly concise and insightful lecturer. And he opened the doors with an African-American art exhibit in the mid-70s, opened the doors to the Black artist, David Driscoll. He was in Maryland in the David Driscoll Center there. He got it going for so many people. And there's other Black artists, you know, that came along. And it's really important. Really, really important for that to happen. The work here with the ribbons started out, it's called Flight Series. And that started in New Mexico with these little paintings. I was out there in Taos, painting on a porch. And there's been like 50 hummingbirds flying all around this porch. Mm. And I started painting the feeling of them buzzing around.
Wow.
And so I have a whole series, small works called Flight, that then grew to this board like that. And I had calligraphic work. And that sort of then reminded me of notes, you know, musical notations in a weird way. Or I also do calligraphy, you know, Asian and Western calligraphy. And so a lot of these grew from letting go of the rigidity and have movement and flight. And then some of the series called Pulse, you have the rhythmic pulse. So the things around it, you know. And then the work in Ireland was about the, part of it was about the layers of earth and digging in to the earth, or all the stuff that's there. And fishing nets and the wiry bushes and all of that turned into these loopy kind of spatial paintings I have.
So do you paint, I know Lily's a big fan of murals.
Yep.
Have you heard of that? Mural things for the times to look out for. Do you have any around the city that you've painted?
I don't know if it's still there now. I used to do a bunch of murals on the metal fronts that were pulled down at night in Codman Square. I don't think this neighborhood didn't kind of like it because it made, they thought it was like more ghetto feeling. It's like, come on. And there was a Reggie Lewis mural in Dorchester Fields Corner, I think. I didn't paint it, but I just helped with that one. And then in Concord, Massachusetts, there was a mural I did on the Concord, at the Concord Depot train station. And it's sort of realistic imaging of, you know, what you see when you take the train to Walla Pond. So mural in Concord Depot was through Emerson Umbrella Arts Organization and Concord. And I went out there every day. First, I did some lessons with kids after when they spent school, get out in June, or during June when they come on Saturday. So I did some painting stuff, and then I'd have to set up the scaffolding and take it down every day. Mm-hmm. And pack up all my paints in my car every day. And I spent about 3 months on it. It was a couple of weeks I wasn't doing it, but it was took a long time. And I think it's in disrepair right now. But it's a good one. If you stand at a very special spot, the perspective lines up with the entire scene around it. So I planned it to line up perfectly with the horizon. Mm. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
so with Ireland, you were talking about that earlier.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Ireland influenced your painting style.
Yeah, it was at Ballyglen Arts Foundation in Ballycastle, County Mayo, Ireland. And then I traveled around Ireland for 2 weeks. And then I was in residence for 6 weeks and another, I was there for 3 months. Hmm. And I was living there. It's really nice. I lived right on the coast. There was a palm tree. There was all these adventures. Well, so all of those experiences maybe, you know, internalize the both the bramble and the fishing ropes, and also this silvery light on the horizon of the ocean. Mm. And it's a special thing. There's a word for it. I can't remember. But it's a very silvery feeling. It's special. It's really interesting. So I did a lot of linear horizontal line works, too, about that. And so it came back basically with over 100 paintings on paper. They told me, stop painting. Go visit. Go tour. So then I did travel all around the West Coast and up to Mallon Head, stayed at Bushmills, Whiskey Place and Hotel, and down to, went to Belfast and in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And then I was at, then I had from Dublin, I went to London, but I ended up going to Venice Biennale in 2007. I was there for 3 days because that's all I could do. It was a really lovely hotel on the canal and going. And one of the main reasons I wanted to go was because I wanted to go, I'd never been to Italy. And a roommate of mine at Skowhegan was the guy selected to curate the entire show. It's like, I'm lucky to have all these people, you know, it's like, I have them.
Where do you want to start with music?
I grew up in a church. My dad was a minister, brother was a minister, and my grandfather, they're all Methodist ministers. And so I always had, you know, church music. It was very white. It was very 4/4 time. It was like marching kind of, some beautiful, some annoying. And then I would play the piano. And one time my parents weren't home. I don't know. I think it was the fourth grade. Let's see, fifth grade maybe. And I took all the cardboard boxes I could find in the house. It was about 25 of them. Stacked them all up, and it was a drum set. And I put on some Ed Sullivan bongo music record we had. And I said, drumming away in all these boxes and breaking them, kicking them around. So, you know, it's just fun stuff, you know. Nobody ever saw it. Nobody knew. I put them all away. You know, it was my thing, you know. And then I had some piano, but I changed. And my mother's piano teacher, and I just had 4 years, we moved, and I didn't like the new piano teacher. She didn't like her lipstick, and she was like annoying. So I get, interested. And then I started doing a little bit more in high school, but my wife, she's such a good pianist. Mm-hmm. I don't enjoy sight reading. Mm-hmm. So, if you can't do that, you got to go to the woodshed and do it. but I can follow symphonic scores and I know what's going on. So musically, I played the saw. My brother had a roommate that played this musical saw. He challenged me, my oldest brother, to play it. And I found that I could do it. But I tortured people like 3 years. It was really hard to get a consistent sound and tone. But I would end up playing in church. Every goddamn Methodist hymnal, pretty much. and so I would play that. And then in the late 70s, we started doing street music and playing all kinds of stuff. And then in 1980, it was more blues with the Cambridge Harmonica Orchestra. And let's say it turned me on to all kinds of place people. And I would sit in, and I was with a band, Shirley Lewis band, for quite a while. And I was with my own band, Sawbones and the Cut-Ups. And it was with, oh my God, Mr. Bones and another guy, two other guys. So then we had the harmonica orchestra, and we called it both the Minuteman harmonica band. Like, if we wanted to turn out a gig because we all couldn't do it, then I was sort of in charge of gigging and paying, like, for five harp players or some event, So we do that. But I would play at every place in Boston, every blues and jazz club in Boston played at it. And get to know a lot of people. There was a place on Route 9, like 1982 or something, whatever it was called. And it was the only blues jam session around. And so we'd go out there. And then I said to a guy, Silas Hubbard. And then we would, after that, we'd go to Tam O'Shanter. And from there, it was the Blue Lodge. And before that, it was a place in Cambridge. And then it moved on to a lot of players would hang out at the 1369 Jazz Club in Hampshire, I guess it was. And then that was the best. You would play all, the Southern Fruit, play blues all afternoon. And then at 8 o'clock, Bunny Smith would come in and play jazz all night. Mm-hmm. And people would come in and out of there. And there's all these people. Sandman Sims, he brings his little board, they do his tap dancing. It's there, it's just so many people in and out of there, so many bands formed there. It was really wonderful. One time I would play at Scholars, often I would play there, sitting in or doing stuff. There's a hang. And Soundman knew me there, and Bobby Boogland was playing there. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to go see him. And I was with my friend Shirley Lewis, and we're sitting on the close up, and he leans over the first bridge of his first song. Mm-hmm. Says, "That's your saw tonight?" I didn't bring it. My one time playing with Bobby Boogland, I couldn't do it. I did this. Rats, Mm-hmm. And then I would tour with Shirley Lewis. We'd go to Iowa, Atlanta, Chattanooga, different places. Mm-hmm. So I like doing that. I could do that in the summer. I could do it anytime now if I wanted. I mean, you don't get paid. I mean, it's like maybe you break even, unless you're like, really high-end deal. So stuff like that. It's really, really, it was a Philadelphia Folk Festival. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's great. I was there with Shirley Lewis and the Dixie Hummingbirds, Dave Van Ronk, and this lady who's now, I knew when she was just starting off, Les Sampoo. And she's been around for quite a while. She's really good. But she was there. And people would go camping and stuff.
Let's talk about the education.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. I've done so many things in teaching that I really learned how to teach when I was in Dorchester with Joe Carbonito at this alternative school with difficult students, you know? And it really is about the kids' feelings about, do you see me? Do you know me? How you connect? And I connected artist to artist. I'm not their regular teacher. I would come into the classroom and model the artistic behavior I have for students to hopefully never catch on. You know, there's a whole scenario called teaching artistic behavior tab, which is pretty popular. And it turns out when I was teaching in Newton, I was part of the group that created teaching artistic behavior like in 81, you know, 82, 81, whatever. So my MO is I come into the classroom as an artist and share my work and experience with students. And at different institutions, it's different. So at the alternative school, I just was myself. You know, and actually I had a Caribbean festival. I did all this cooking, all this artist stuff, you know. But at group schools, I was just learning, and learning this open classroom and what's now called teaching artistic behavior. I was part of that whole group. My current or previous boss didn't quite understand my background about that. You know, all these things are not an art studio experience. You go to the studio and you just think and feel. And so that's what the AP kids could do. Mm. And they had to create their own inquiry, do their research, experiment, and revisions and submission and all that. It was really rigorous. And then I'm an AP reader, so I would score, you know, a lot. There was 74, 5,000 this year to score on Utah. So I would do those things administratively, and I also do a lot of union work. So I was kind of very involved in the school culture. It's always good to know your custodians and help them and deans, you know, cover for them when they need help. So, but in the end, I really just valued the one-on-one, great moving times. And really, I have so many letters from students. I had one student photographer, world-renowned photographer now. You know, so many people, you don't know who you've influenced till maybe later, and never know. So, that's like this thing with Steve Cannon, pass off the energy to the next generation and quote, get it done. Like students, it's due, get it done.
Yeah.
You know, you can wallow in a creative malaise of fantasy and never really get to where you might be able to if you just don't have the discipline.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether you feel inspired that day, it didn't matter. You can get to work. You know, the same thing, you can practice music. If you're going to write, well, keep writing. You know, maybe it's not the day for everything to happen, but the act of mixing paint, the act of playing something, or just sitting down at the piano, I didn't think about that before. So it's a happy accident. So the you know, it's just the surprises are really good. So that's why I was always looking for a teaching, the surprise. And so many kids this year, and recently, such more challenges and troubles for them, and COVID relapsing, and phone use, and home life, and just a lot of, being a teenager is really hard.
Yeah.
So, and I taught kindergarten to graduate school, and I was like, you know, review boards for Mass Art graduate school.
That's great, great stories about the education, teaching, and everything. So what's your, you were saying some of it, but what's your vision going forward?
Going forward? Museum of Modern Art, Whitney? Take London? I don't know, major places. I want in the big time, honestly. Before that, I'll be in New York periodically for a week here, a week there. I want to schedule 2 weeks all in the spring, hustle the work. I'd like to have a retrospective, and each room is a section of different styles and how they all relate. People don't see the relationships easily unless you make it happen. I have a collector who might like to do that. So maybe a show like at Boston College locally, the Andover, this place. You know, Mass College of Art. Anyway, maybe college places, not a venue to sell, but to make a statement. And then I have this new relationship with a gallery here in Boston. So we'll see what that, you know, do commissions. It's kind of a weird economic art time, you know? But if I were to give any advice wanting to collect small works on paper, expensive. If you can trade. And I have a collection of incredible outsider art from one guy in New York. I trade all the time. So, and then it leads to more. Then you get informed. Go to the art openings in Boston. Go to the art studios, and you'll see the range of people from jewelers, sculptors, to people starting out, those still, you know, learning, and this was quite a range. And then your hope is to see the level of sophistication you find in New York and other bigger cities. It's hard sometimes to find that. And there's a great show right now with Jerry Bergstein at his Gallery Naga. I used to show there and move to another, and you know, I get bored quick.
Yeah.
But yeah, that, I want to make some, you know, more photography. I have these photos I took off of TV. It's like Andy Warhol invaded the TV. I want to publish that. I have big prints this size of some of them. Maybe do like giant pictures, you know. And then I also have these tar snake photos. And make a movie with that, or make them life size. Find a funder to print those 6-foot photos, do a show and Museum of Fine Arts, some research. No. We'll see.
Yeah.
You know, I want it big. I admit it. And I'm to be arrogant enough, I'm that good. And I want it.
We'll be proud of that.
And you have to own it. And it's just Boston's a tough market for abstract art.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, that's wonderful. Is there any parting words? We have our CEO here. Viewers out there, we have our CEO watching us, his wife watching us. If there are any parting words you'd like to leave all of us with?
What you got, pass on and just get it done. That's the words of Steve Cannon. I can't think of anything better. And never give up, even the worst times. It's the next day. It's like scraping the paint off the canvas. It's a brand new day, and you can start all over.
Wonderful having you.
Thank you.
The incredible David Moore. The incredible paintings. The incredible playing on the saws and everything. Saw music. Being a musician, being an artist, being an educator. And
thank you.
Retired thank you. Now. And just. Yeah. You gave a lot to this world, so thank you so much for being part of this interview. And
all right.
To all the viewers out there, if you'd like to book a lesson with any of the
LTC faculty, go to www.lilytheatercompany.org. Thank you for watching, and we'll see you guys next time.
Yeah, thank you.